Blog Talk Radio.
Talking Law. Talking Law. Talking Law. Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser.
You can't handle the truth.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser analyzes criminal cases in the news, trends in the law, and covers all legal current events.
Overruled.
Our host, criminal defense attorney in New York, Daniel Hochheiser. Each week, Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser features newsmakers, attorneys, media personalities, celebrities, politicians, business people, and so much more. Straight talk, no nonsense. Here's Talking Law with your host, Dan Hochheiser.
March 18th, 2015. Talking Law fans, welcome to show number 25. I hope you have enjoyed our shows over the last several months as much as I've enjoyed doing them. As our veteran listeners know, this show is intended to entertain, educate, and include our listeners in the conversation about the hot legal issues of the day. This is an interactive show. We want to hear from you. Send me an email, talkinlaw@gmail.com. Remember, no G in talkin, talkinlaw@gmail.com. Please like our Facebook page to keep up with show updates at facebook.com/talkinlaw. Follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, Hochheiser. And listen to all our prior episodes on blogtalkradio.com/talkinlaw, or you can get all the prior episodes on iTunes. Our last show was fantastic. We had Sidney Powell, former Justice Department attorney, who wrote a very interesting book, License to Lie, Exposing Corruption in the Department of Justice. It really is a great book which describes systemic prosecutorial misconduct alleged during the federal investigations of Enron, Arthur Anderson, Merrill Lynch, and Senator Ted Stevens. I encourage everybody to go to licensetolie.com or amazon.com to get a copy of this book, which was referred to by Senator Orrin Hatch during recent confirmation hearings of Attorney General nominee Loretta Lynch. So, what are we going to do for the next 43 minutes? We are going to interview an authority on the laws of self-defense, who I will introduce in a moment. We will then go to the question of the day. Then we will hear from Beth Karras, who will give us all the latest on the aftermath of the Robert Durst arrest in New Orleans, and that will be our 25th broadcast. Let's go. Let's do this. We have today a special guest all the way from Utah. James D. Mitch Velos is an attorney in Utah who has been practicing law since 1978. He has been selected by Utah Business Magazine as one of Utah's top lawyers. Mitch is the author of Self-Defense Laws of All 50 States, which is currently in its second edition and is available at Amazon.com, or you can order a copy by phone at 801-560-7117. Mitch is also a Utah State authorized concealed weapon instructor. Mitch is a great champion of the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution and is in the forefront of efforts to improve self-defense laws across the United States. You can find out more about our guest after the show by visiting www.firearmslaw.com. Mitch Velos, are you with me?
Yes, Dan. It's good to be with you this morning. Hey, can I give you a better number to order the book by phone? It's an 800
Please.
Number. 800-530-0222.
Great. Can you say it one more time?
800-530-0222. Just ask for Arlene, and she'll get you a book.
Fantastic. And I urge everybody to, whether you're a lawyer or a non-lawyer, I read quite a bit of the book. It's not a book you have to read from start to finish. It is a reference book, but you can read it from start to finish. It's an easy read. It's packed with information lawyers need to know about self-defense, and also lay people need to understand about self-defense, and it's written in a very plain talk style, which is really easily digestible and, frankly, real fun to read. So, Mitch, thanks for writing this book.
Well, it was a work in progress, and we enjoyed it. I hope the people that read it enjoy it as much as we enjoyed writing it and putting it together. Like you say, it is an easy read. Some people say they can read it, you know, with reference to their own state in 3 hours. And we reveal the hidden legal traps in the law of self-defense, some of which aren't even written. You know, we've noticed there are some facts that can be in certain cases or incidents that tend to increase the probability of arrest, prosecution, and conviction. And we focus on those and tell people how to avoid them. And so I think, you know, we're hoping that it's going to be a blessing and save people's lives and save people's fortunes.
Now, Mitch, let me just back up a little bit. Can we start out with the basics? Can you give us sort of a common denominator of what a criminal defendant on trial anywhere in the United States has to establish at a minimum to make out a valid self-defense argument at trial?
Well, in only one state does he have the burden of proof, and that's South Carolina. But in other states, the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he did not act in self-defense. Now, there are cases where the defendant claims it was an accident that the gun went off, and you don't get – a lot of judges won't even let you go into self-defense under those circumstances. Or, you know, if it's obviously not a self-defense, if it's a premeditated murder-type situation and there's really no evidence of self-defense, then the judge is not going to let you even raise the issue. But otherwise, the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt in 49 of the 50 – states that that it wasn't an act of self-defense. So it's the burden is on the state.
And that's real important for practitioners to understand. I mean, where I practice here in New York, the prosecutor does have to prove, as you say, disprove beyond a reasonable doubt the justification defense, which is what we call it in New York under Penal Law Article 35. Mitch, but you can't just get a jury instruction from a judge without eliciting any evidence to make
self-defense
argument.
Sure.
So that's really what I'm getting at. What elements are common to every state in the country which have to be raised during the evidence? Not that you have the burden as a defendant, but what has to be raised in order to convince a judge to give you a self-defense instruction before the jury deliberates?
Well, in virtually every state, there has to be some evidence that there was an imminent threat of deadly force or serious bodily injury that the defendant was facing, and that the force he used was necessary and not excessive in order to raise that defense. There's got to be some evidence of that. If there's no evidence of it, you're not going to get the jury instruction.
And what is there a difference between what the courts mean by imminent in different states in the country?
I think the concept's the same. The language often differs. It kind of makes me smile a little bit when I read Alabama's rule. It's instead of the word imminence, they say about to, and that makes more sense to them down there. But and I think that's a pretty descriptive term too. It's about to happen immediately. It's got to be a present threat, something that's about to happen. I think they nailed it when they used that term in Alabama.
And when I read a lot of your book, and it seems to me that a lot of jurisdictions, including New York, they include language in their self-defense statutes which talk about that the conduct of the person defending themselves or a third person or a property has to be reasonable and necessary. How does that play into a self-defense claim in terms of whether the standard is going to be a subjective, objective, or some kind of mixed standard to make out the claim?
Well, like you say, it's an objective standard. If somebody's, for example, afraid of germs, you know, and somebody gets too close to them, and so that person unreasonably believes that he's about to be killed because of somebody's close proximity, and he draws his gun and shoots that person that's getting too close to him, that's not going to work. That's not going to be a reasonable, reasonably necessary, and that's why it's got to be a reasonable man standard.
So, what was it? I know, Mitch, that you do a lot of civil litigation, and you've been quite successful in recovering large awards for your personal injury clients. What was it that originally sparked your interest in the law of self-defense in the criminal realm?
Well, I saw what was going on with the Second Amendment, that it was being shoved aside and ignored in many instances, and legislated out of existence. And also, what happened was I had two teenage sons, and I didn't want them to inadvertently break one of the or violate one of the obscure gun laws of Utah. And so I started compiling the laws just into a file, a computer file, and then realized that because of the legalese, the way lawyers write, it wasn't going to be easy for people to understand, or my sons. And I started explaining what these laws meant and how they interacted. So we did that for Utah, and we ended up with a book called Utah Gun Law, Good, Bad, and Ugly. And then I started getting criminal cases, which got me into the courtroom more often, which I enjoy, and which gives me, you know, makes me a better civil law lawyer as well, trial lawyer. And as I started taking criminal cases related to weapons, I found out that one of the most serious areas and is the law of self-defense, because in a self-defense incident, if you don't understand the law, you have much more to lose under those circumstances than any other weapons violation. And so I felt, wow, we've got to expand on the self-defense chapter. So my son was just getting out of a pre-law school, and I said, why don't you see how difficult it would be to put together the self-defense laws of every state, because in Utah we have a self-defense statute. Just pull those up, and we'll do a plain talk summary of what's required. Well, we got into that and found out that some states don't have statutes. Other states that have statutes don't even look at the statute. They've developed the law, the case law, and jury instructions, and people that rely on the statutes in those states really are not up to date. You know, some of those statutes are written, like in California, in the late 1800s, Nevada as well. And so we realized we were in trouble. We hired a group of top BYU, Brigham Young University law students to help us finish the book, and that's how we came up with the self-defense laws of all 50 states, and we've been keeping it updated online as we go. We're now in our second edition, as you pointed out earlier.
Mitch, we're going to get further into the laws of self-defense. You're listening to Talkin' Law with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking with Mitch Velos, author of Self-Defense Laws of All 50 States. Mitch, I do some private security volunteer work. So this next question is very meaningful for me and the organization I volunteer with. So if you don't mind, I'm going to give you a scenario, and I want to get your thoughts on this, because I think a lot of private security professionals, whether they're volunteer or paid, don't really understand what their legal obligations are in terms of use of force, et cetera. So let's say we have John Doe, who's a man who's part of a volunteer private security team used by a church in New Jersey to ensure the safety of the church congregation during Sunday morning services. What self-defense issues must John Doe and the other members of his private security team keep in mind in disputes which could arise with members of the public seeking to enter the church?
Well, We found, you know, of course, the words we talked about, the concepts we talked about earlier, the you know, acting reasonably under the circumstances, making sure that there's an imminent threat of deadly force, if you're gonna even threaten deadly force or use deadly force. If you're in New Jersey, you better make sure, or in New York City, you better make sure that your firearm is registered, or you're going to get in trouble anyway. And we find that that's one of what we call thumbs down factors in our analysis of self-defense cases. If you have an illegal gun or you're acting otherwise illegally, the case is going to be looked at a lot closer for the issue of self-defense than if it was just you didn't have those factors involved. And I'm just looking.
So let's say, Mitch, let's say that John Doe is this private security guy who's standing watch at his church, and somebody tries to come into the church, and for whatever reason he thinks they're up to no good, he denies them access, and a confrontation ensues. Any advice for John Doe in that situation?
Yeah, read our book, because there's about 25, 30 hidden legal traps in the law of self-defense that we cover in our book. And it starts out with the ones that are written that people tend to ignore. Escalation, initial aggressor. Incidentally, New York has one of the best definitions of being the initial aggressor. You don't have to, you don't have to take a blow before you can respond with force, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you can respond with deadly force. One of the hidden legal traps is that if your adversary does not have a weapon and you go to weapons, whether you just threaten with the weapon or you, heaven forbid, shoot the person, and when the police show up, he has no weapon, we call that one of the most prevalent and common thumbs down factors of having you arrested for murder or attempted murder. And most self-defense statutes relate to or have a exceptions to the law of self-defense, starting out with whether or not you are the initial aggressor. And that, incidentally, was the real issue in the Trayvon Martin case. Who was the initial aggressor? Stand Your Ground didn't have much to do with the case because if you believe Mr. Zimmerman's testimony, he was attacked and was on the ground before he ever went to guns. So there's the initial aggressor issue. You've got to make sure that it doesn't look like mutual combat. If it's something that you can de-escalate or call the police, you have time to call the police, you better do that. If you're a private security person, rather than being a macho jerk or thug, and pushing people around to the point where you've either provoked or given the impression that you want to engage in mutual combat, and hey, buddy, if you want to raise it to the level of the use of deadly force, I'm prepared to do that. That's the kind of forceful activity that tends to really get people into trouble and have them fall into the legal traps that are usually contained within the laws, which include initial aggressor, provocation, mutual combat, or committing a felony in and of itself prior to what the victim does, and he'll be claiming if he lives that he was simply defending himself. And when you get into those situations, it's complicated enough that police and prosecutors are just going to file the charges and let the fact finder, the jury or the judge, decide who the initial aggressor was or who had an opportunity to de-escalate and didn't, and then you're into it for hundreds of thousands of dollars of defense costs. So
you're listening to Talk of Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking with Mitch Velos, author of Self-Defense Laws of All 50 States. Mitch, you raised the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman situation, which, as everybody who reads the papers knows, occurred in Florida with the death of Trayvon Martin and the acquittal of George Zimmerman, who raised the self-defense claim. But like the Zimmerman case, where Zimmerman followed Trayvon Martin, you also describe a frightening case in your book in Chapter 2, the Harmon case, where that's another situation where somebody trying to protect a community follows people suspected of being up to no good and winds up with problems. Tell us a little bit about the Harmon case and why you included it in the book.
Well, Harmon was kind of a shock and awe because, you know, I mean, as I did the gun shows and things like this, interacted with the public, you see people coming out of concealed carry classes with this macho attitude, and, you know, they're going to be protectors of the community. They're going to be one of the fearsome four or, you know, superheroes. And, you know, I wanted to show how making many of the mistakes that we cover in Chapter 7, the hidden legal traps or thumbs down factors, how those can lead to a murder charge, even though you think you're doing something admirable. This man was a elderly person. He had everything paid off. He was retired, and he lived in his cabin, in a cabin community up in the mountains above Fillmore, Utah. And there were two young punks, basically, that were just hanging out and wanted to go fishing up in the mountains and got stuck. And up above his cabin and came into the cabin community looking for a phone to call help, call a tow truck to help them get out of the mud. Well, he looked out his window and saw them rattling doors, different cabins. He'd been drinking. You know, they came up to his door and rattled it. He just assumed that it was an attempted burglary. And so he went out and told them to leave, and they walked down the road, and he fought. You know, it took several minutes until he got in his truck, put his gun in his truck, went down on the road, pulled in front of them, stopped his truck, opened the door, and as they approached, you know, he asked them what they were doing. He said he felt threatened. He pulled out his gun, said, "Don't come any closer." They continued to advance. The forensic evidence was that the one kid that was actually a convicted, he had been convicted of a felony drug offense, had come within about a foot of his the barrel of the gun, and the other kid was kind of circling around. The jury apparently believed the kids were just trying to avoid him. And anyway, he draws his gun, shoots his kid in the face, kills him, and the other kid takes off running, and he shoots, and shoots several times, hits him in the back of the arm. The kid gets away in the scrub oak, and so this guy calls 911 and says he was stopping burglars, and that they attacked him, and that he used his gun in self-defense because he was afraid they were going to take his gun away from him and kill him with it. And so that's basically the facts of the story. And they tried that case in front of a jury, and the jury felt that those kids were simply, you know, looking for someone to help them out of the mud, and that this guy was the initial aggressor and shot and killed him. And I think they even allowed the evidence of the kid's background, which was not good, you know. But there was a jury of six women, I think, and two men convicted this man of murder of the one boy and attempted murder of the other boy.
And I said,
boy, you know, they were in their early
20s.
He's serving life in prison? Life in prison.
And it seems to me, you know, with your description of the forensics in the Harmon case, I think it may have been important from my reading that one of these guys, one of these men, took a bullet in the back of the arm, and that triggered my recollection of the facts of the police officer Darren Wilson shooting of Eric Garner in Ferguson, Missouri, where I think a big part of the grand jury's decision not to indict Officer Wilson in that case was because all the shots were found to have entered Eric Garner's body in the front. So am I correct in thinking that shots entering from the back of somebody is a big thumbs down factor, as you would call it?
It's a big thumbs down factor. You know, we learned from the cowboy shows we probably all watched, you know, that only cowards shoot people in the back. And I think that one of the conclusions you could draw from the Harmon case was that he was trying to kill the witness before he got away, and dead men tell no lies. And that's another thing, you know, use of excessive force. This kid was on the run, and I think the jury used that fact, the shooting through the back of the arm, as some indication of what this man's intent was from the beginning. So, you know, and he'd been drinking. That's another thumbs down factor. You know, he was acting like a cop, and he's not. He's chasing them down the street. You know, why not just call the police, let them question him? He had plenty of time. He had plenty of time to call afterwards, you know. And he had plenty of time. You know, they walked, I think it was a half a mile down the road, see. So, you know, he certainly had time to call the police and let them handle it. And that's what we encourage people to do. If there's time, why not let the police take the risk instead of you taking the risk of losing everything?
Now, Mitch, you mentioned the concept of possibly killing a witness, or somebody had a theory that that perhaps the other kid was shot because this guy wanted to kill the witness. We've seen in the news the last several days a lot about Robert Durst's arrest in New Orleans for the L.A. killing of Susan Berman, who, according to the authorities, was killed because she was about to speak to the authorities about the disappearance of Durst's wife in 1982. But what I want to ask you about is Robert Durst's 2003 trial, in which he was acquitted on a self-defense theory of killing his neighbor Morris Black, who he admitted killing. He chopped him up, and then the authorities found Black's torso floating in the Galveston Bay. I've been asked this by the media, and I've given my views. What are your views on why that Texas jury acquitted Robert Durst of the murder of Morris Black?
Well, you know, honestly, Dan, I haven't followed that, all of the factors in that case, because it didn't strike me as a self-defense case. I don't know if he raised the issue of self-defense with his neighbor or what, but, I mean, that's a very unusual verdict given the facts. I mean, you know, that's another of our thumbs-down factors. If you don't go to the authorities right after or try to get some medical help to somebody that you've shot is wounded or whatever, you know, that tends to show your motive as well. And, you know, chopping somebody up or wrapping them, and we've had a case out here where a man was convicted after he claimed self-defense, but he wrapped the guy up in cellophane and buried him in the desert out by Wendover, Nevada. You know, and so that's kind of the same thing as fleeing from the incident afterwards. What does that tend to infer? It infers guilt, see? So I don't know if the guy that he killed was such a undesirable that the jury thought, well, he deserved to die, you know, because that's the old attack the victim defense. So I'm really not up to speed, but somebody did some pretty good lawyering, right, in that first case.
I believe that's Mr. DeGuerin, who has been hired again by Mr. Durst to defend him when he gets to L.A. to face the charges of first-degree murder and the death of Susan Berman. Mitch Velos, that's the end of our time. I want to thank you for spending time with us this morning, for waking up early, and you and your son really did a great job with this book, and I hope you'll come back on the show in the future.
Just let me know, Dan. I enjoyed it as well. Appreciate what you're doing.
Very good. Mitch Velos, thank you again. Take care now.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Before we get to our question of – before we get to Beth, rather, Beth Karras will give us all the latest news on the Robert Durst prosecution in – New Orleans and L.A., what's happening. There's lots to talk about. We're going to do the question of the day first. The question of the day is, if Robert Durst is convicted of murder in the first degree for the year 2000 execution of Susan Berman in California, could he be sentenced to death? Now, give me Beth Karras.
Beth, what can
Talkin' Law Radio brings you a live Karras on Crime special report from Beth Karras, former prosecutor, court TV HLN television correspondent and founder of CarisOnCrime.com. Now here's Beth with the latest legal news.
Beth, what can I do?
Good morning, Beth.
Good morning.
So, we have Mr. Robert Durst, who I believe is incarcerated in New Orleans at the moment, and he has been arrested on a warrant for the California killing of Susan Berman, his former friend and spokesperson. And also now he's having some problems with a gun charge and marijuana charges in New Orleans. Give us the latest.
Now, it appears he's going to fight those charges first in New Orleans, but we'll wait and see if things actually change. He's not going to California right away, and he's been moved about an hour outside of New Orleans to a facility that can cope with mental health issues. That's what's being reported a little better. I mean, yeah, does he have some mental infirmities? Probably, but he's been pretty crafty for three decades, if indeed he's committed three killings. We know he committed one and successfully defended himself against it, but if he did the other two, the disappearance of his wife of 9 years in 1982 and the execution-style shot to the back of the head murder of Susan Berman, in 2000, then, you know, he's not that mentally ill, right? In any event, he's in trouble now. Okay, so what's going on
Beth,
here?
And Beth, before you move on, Beth, before you move on from that point, I thought I saw on the news his attorney, Mr. DeGuerin, say emphatically that he is legally fine. He's sane. He's not in need of any mental health counseling, and all they want to do is go to California and fight these charges, which are nothing more than driven by a television show instead of facts.
Well, the conclusion about his mental state comes from the sheriff's department. They're the ones who moved him to another facility because of this mental health condition, is what they're saying. So I don't know what the sheriff's department is observing while he's incarcerated, but that's not coming from DeGuerin. So he's taking issue with what the sheriff's department is saying, but the ones in custody have control, the ones who are holding him in custody have control over what happens to him right now. In any event, how did this all come about? Well, I mean, you've been talking about it already with your prior guest, Mitch Vilos, but we know that, you know, Robert Durst has been a suspect in his wife's disappearance in 1982, and then in 2000, when his close friend, Susan Berman, was about to be questioned by law enforcement authorities about the disappearance of his first wife, and it is believed she may have known something after the fact, during whatever, all of a sudden, she turns up dead. This is a few days before Christmas in 2000. And she's in her house, and the dead, her dogs are running around outside, and the police receive this cryptic note saying, you know, basically alerting them to a cadaver with the address in Beverly Hills, in Benedict Canyon. And Beverly is misspelled. Okay, they looked at that handwriting thinking that maybe it was Durst's handwriting, but they couldn't prove it at that time. So the case goes a little cold for a while, but he's always kind of been on the radar. A year later, he surfaces charged with murder in Texas. That's the case you talked about. He had been living as a woman, as a mute woman. So he wasn't talking and, you know, exposing his male voice, right? He was living as a woman and when he killed his neighbor in an apartment house in Galveston, Texas. Okay, that was a year after Susan Berman. He got arrested in Pennsylvania after that shoplifting. That's when they found him in the Morris Black. That's the Galveston case when he got arrested shoplifting in Pennsylvania. He's estranged from his family. They bought him out, but he has money. His family had a restraining order against him, and he did get arrested here for violating the restraining order because he went close to the, you know, of one of the family homes, and he was caught, you know, approaching, violating the restraining order. So now, these documentary makers are for a decade have been working this story. They interviewed him twice, in 2010 and 2012. And what we all heard on the last episode of HBO's The Jinx was recorded in 2012. They claim they didn't even hear that recording for a couple of years when they're like logging tapes and had some assistants who found it. You know, just because you have a hot microphone on doesn't mean it's being captured.
Beth, let me stop you just there because we have a very short audio clip of this, what people are referring to as a confession made by Robert Durst in the bathroom after that season, that sixth show of The Jinx, that HBO special. Mark, please roll that clip.
Kill them all, of course.
Now, Beth, I believe that's a portion of the audio where Mr. Durst says, on that hot mic, I killed them all, of course. And everybody's talking about this statement. What do you think about the admissibility of that statement in a future trial of Mr. Durst for the killing of Susan Berman?
Well, if I had to tell you right now, and we don't know everything and how it's going to be litigated, I'd say it is admissible. These producers were not working with the police. There's no what we call state action there. They did not, it does not appear that they were intentionally recording and creating this, you know, electronic eavesdropping device. But even if they were, I'm not so sure that even if they were doing it intentionally, it was wrong. And actually, a lot of the discussion I'm hearing is veering away from admissibility and into whether how it will be interpreted in court. A lot of legal experts are saying they think it's probably going to come in, but what will Dick DeGaron, his defense attorney, do with it? These are just musings of a diseased mind, or the tape doesn't really, the recording doesn't really say what the prosecutors think it says. But I am also concerned about the ethics behind, you know, how this went down in the timeline. Because the producers say they gave it to the police last June, and it just so happens that the police arrest him on the eve of the last episode. Now, HBO wasn't involved at all in this because HBO, they say they acquired the rights to this six-part documentary series, you know, much closer in time to the airing of it. But the documentary producers have very smartly shut up by noon on Monday because they realize that it's going to become an issue, you know, the chronology of events and when they turned it over to law enforcement. It does appear they were not working with law enforcement. They gave it to the police last June. The police had all the information, presumably, that we know now in June of last year. Were they keeping him under surveillance? Maybe so. Maybe they were going to pounce on him if he left the country, you know, between now and the airing of the show. But it is a little suspicious that Durst checked into a hotel the day before the last episode aired. This would be last Saturday, under a fake name. And, you know, it is believed he may have been taking a nonstop flight to Cuba. I don't know if he had tickets on him or what, but that's when they found the gun and marijuana. I mean, it was proper for the police to arrest him at that time. Maybe it was totally coincidental, and they would have arrested him 3 months ago if he was doing the same thing. But that needs to be explained.
Beth, let's talk about the famous cadaver letter now. I watched that sixth episode, and I watched parts of it more than once because they're so gripping. The moment where Jarecki, the director, interviews Durst and shows him this note written to the Beverly Hills Police Department shortly after Susan Berman's death, which says the cadaver is at a particular address in Beverly Hills, and is compared to this letter written by Durst to Susan Berman in 1999, which is turned over to HBO by Berman's stepson. There's really that Columbo moment where Jarecki shows him the word Beverly Hills blown up on the two different documents. Tell us about that and what you think the significance might be
in
future litigation.
Natural. Right, it was a great work on the part of the producer because he gets Durst to admit that he wrote the 1999 envelope. Yeah, I wrote that. I wrote that to her. It was a note. He was probably enclosing some money or something to her, he says. But then he denies writing the cadaver note. And then, as you say, Beverly, which is misspelled, it's L-E-Y by the writer, Beverly is taken from both letters, and blown up on this big card and shown to him. He's like, well, which one of these did you write? He doesn't know which one came from the cadaver letter, which one from the envelope, and he's like, I can't tell you. I mean, I know that's not a forensic examiner's, it's not the same as a forensic examiner testifying, saying, yes, these are identical and here are the points and why. But this is the man saying, yeah, I wrote one of those and I can't tell you which one. They're so close, basically. Right after that, he gets up to go to the bathroom, and that's when these admissions come out. And I think it's very suspicious, you know, and very bad for him, the timing of it. It's not like these musings in the bathroom were on a different day or hours later. They come right on the heels seconds after he's confronted with his handwriting. And those two taken together is great evidence. I mean, there was probable cause to arrest him that day in 2012.
Beth, I tend to agree with you, and I think that the statements in the bathroom, I also think they're going to be admissible, and I think they may kickstart the Westchester County District Attorney's Office reinvestigation into the death of Kathleen Durst. I know you'll be watching it. Beth Karas, KarasOnCrime.com. Beth, thank you as always.
My pleasure. Talk to you next week.
See ya. Okay, now we get to the answer to the question of the day. The question of the day is, if Robert Durst is convicted of murder in the first degree for the year 2000 execution of Susan Berman in California, could he be sentenced to death? Answer. Well, we have three answers in three states. In California, the answer is legally and practically speaking, he won't be sentenced to death anytime soon because a federal judge in the Central District of California this past summer struck down the application of California's death penalty law as unconstitutional. The court found that California's death penalty system was arbitrary and that there was no rhyme or reason for the process of selecting which death row inmates were selected for death versus which were spared, or when the penalty would be imposed on those selected for death. Based upon the arbitrariness of the system and upon a finding of long delays in carrying out the death penalty, the California federal court said the system amounted to a violation of the U.S. Constitution's Eighth Amendment prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. You can read the decision yourself at Jones versus Chappelle, 31 F. Sup. 3rd, 1050. It's a Central District, California 2014 case. The case is currently on appeal to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. So for Durst to be eligible for the death penalty in the Susan Berman case, first the Ninth Circuit would have to reverse the district court. And even then, according to deathpenaltyinfo.org, quote, of the more than 900 individuals that have been sentenced to death since 1978, only 13 have been executed. For every one inmate executed by California, seven have died on death row, most from natural causes. The review process takes an average of 25 years, and the delay is only getting longer. No inmate has been executed in California since 2006. So for the Berman case, I don't expect Durst to ever be sentenced to the death penalty. In New York, you might ask, well, what if New York someday prosecutes Durst for the 1982 disappearance of his wife, Kathleen? Durst will not face the death penalty, as New York does not have the death penalty. In 2004, the death penalty statute of New York was struck down on New York State constitutional grounds by New York's highest court in People versus Laval, 3 New York 3rd 88. That's a 2004 New York Court of Appeals case. So there would have to be a change in New York law for Durst to be eligible for death in New York in the disappearance of Kathleen Durst. How about Texas? Well, not in Texas either, because although Texas has the death penalty, Durst has already been acquitted of the 2001 murder of Morris Black in Galveston, Texas, so he will not face the Texas death penalty as he is protected by double jeopardy prohibitions. Thank you to Mitch Velos. I highly recommend his book, Self-Defense Laws of All 50 States. You can get the book for $9.99 for your Kindle at Amazon, or at the beginning of the show, Mitch gave you the phone number. You can order it. Beth Karas, thank you. Please subscribe to her site, KarasOnCrime.com, for all the latest inside legal news. Thank you to my producer, Mark Goldman. Next show will be Wednesday at 9:30 a.m. Thank you for listening through 25 shows. I wish everybody peace and justice.